Once, during a vigorous discussion on the relative merits of the two political systems, Ellie had boasted that she had been free to march in front of the White House protesting American involvement in the Vietnam War. Vega replied that in the same period, he had been equally free to march in front of the Kremlin protesting American involvement in the Vietnam War. He had never been inclined, say, to photograph the garbage scows burdened with malodorous refuse and squawking seagulls lumbering in front of the Statue of Liberty, as another Soviet scientist had, when for fun she had escorted him on the Staten Island ferry during a break in a meeting in New York City. Nor had he, as had some of his colleagues, ardently photographed the tumble-down shanties and corrugated metal huts of the Puerto Rican poor during a bus excursion from a luxurious beachfront hotel to the Arecibo Observatory. To whom did they submit these pictures, Ellie wondered. She conjured up some vast KGB library dedicated to the infelicities, injustices, and contradictions of capitalist society. Did it warm them, when disconsolate with some of the failures of Soviet society, to browse through the fading snapshots of their imperfect American cousins? There were many brilliant scientists in the Soviet Union who, for unknown offenses, had not been permitted out of Eastern Europe in decades. Konstantinov, for example, had never been to the West until the mid-1960s. When, at an international meeting in Warsaw, over a table encumbered with dozens of depleted Azerbaijani brandy snifters, their missions completed, Konstantinov was asked, why? He replied, because the bastards know they let me out, I never come back. Nevertheless, they had let him out, sure enough, during the thaw in scientific relations between the two countries in the late 60s and early 70s, and he had come back every time. But now they let him out no more, and he was reduced to sending his Western colleagues New Year's cards, in which he portrayed himself forlornly cross-legged, head bowed, seated on a sphere, below which was the Schwarzschild equation for the radius of a black hole. He was in a deep potential well, he would tell visitors to Moscow in the metaphors of physics. They would never let him out again. In response to questions, Vega would say that the official Soviet position was that the Hungarian Revolution of 1956 had been organized by crypto-fascists, and that the Prague Spring of 1968 was brought about by an unrepresentative, anti-socialist group in the leadership. But, he would add, if what he had been told was mistaken, if these were genuine popular uprisings, then his country had been wrong in suppressing them. On Afghanistan, he did not even bother quoting the official justifications. Once in his office at the Institute, he had insisted on showing Ellie his personal shortwave radio, on which were frequencies labeled London and Paris and Washington, neatly spelled out in Cyrillic letters. He was free, he told her, to listen to the propaganda of all nations. There had been a time when many of his fellows had surrendered to national rhetoric about the yellow peril. Imagine the entire frontier between China and the Soviet Union occupied by Chinese soldiers, shoulder to shoulder, an invading army, one of them requested, challenging Ellie's powers of imagination. They were standing around the samovar in the director's office at the Institute. How long would it be, with the present Chinese birth rate, before they all passed over the border? And the answer was pronounced, in an unlikely mix of dark foreboding and arithmetic delight, never. William Randolph Hearst would have felt at home, but not Lunacharsky. Stationing so many Chinese soldiers on the frontier would automatically reduce the birth rate, he argued. Their calculations were therefore in error. He had phrased it as though the misuse of mathematical models was the subject of his disapproval, but few mistook his meaning. In the worst of the Sino-Soviet tensions, he had never, so far as Ellie knew, allowed himself to be swept up in the endemic paranoia and racism. Ellie loved the samovars, and could understand the Russian affection for them. Their Lunokhod, The successful unmanned lunar rover that looked like a bathtub on wire wheels seemed to her to have a little samovar technology somewhere in its ancestry. Vega had once taken her to see a model of Lunokhod in a sprawling exhibition park outside of Moscow on a splendid June morning. There, next to a building displaying the wares and charms of the Tadsik Autonomous Republic, was a great hall filled to the rafters with full-scale models of Soviet civilian space vehicles. Sputnik 1, the first orbital spacecraft. Sputnik 2, the first spacecraft to carry an animal, the dog, Laika, who died in space. Luna 2, the first spacecraft to reach another celestial body. Luna 3, the first spacecraft to photograph the far side of the moon. Venera 7, the first spacecraft to land safely on another planet. And Vostok 1, the first manned spacecraft that carried hero of the Soviet Union, cosmonaut Yuri A. Gagarin, on a single orbit of the Earth. Outside, children were using the fins of the Vostok launch booster as slides, their pretty blonde curls and red Komsomol neckerchiefs flaring as, to much hilarity, they descended to land. Zemlya, it was called in Russian. The large Soviet island in the Arctic Sea was called Novaya Zemlya, New Land. It was there in 1961 that they had detonated a 58-megaton thermonuclear weapon, the largest single explosion so far contrived by the human species. But on that spring day, with the vendors hawking the ice cream in which Moscovites take so much pride, with families on outings, and a toothless old man smiling at Ellie and Lunacharsky as if they were lovers, the old land had seemed nice enough. In her infrequent visits to Moscow or Leningrad, Vega would often arrange the evenings. A group of six or eight of them would go to the Bolshoi or the Kirov Ballet. Lunacharsky somehow would arrange for the tickets. She would thank her hosts for the evening, and they, explaining that it was only in the company of foreign visitors that they themselves were able to attend such performances, would thank her. Vega would only smile. He never brought his wife, and Ellie had never met her. She was, he said, a physician, who was devoted to her patients. Ellie had asked him what his greatest regret was, because his parents had not, as they had once contemplated, emigrated to America.
"I have only one regret," he had said in his gravelly voice. "My daughter married a Bulgarian."
Once he arranged a dinner at a Caucasian restaurant in Moscow. A professional toastmaster or tomada named Kaletsi had been engaged for the evening. The man was a master of this art form, but Ellie's Russian was bad enough that she was obliged to ask for most of the toasts to be translated. He turned to her, and foreshadowing the rest of the evening, remarked,
"We call the man who drinks without a toast an alcoholic."
An early and comparatively mediocre toast had ended to peace on all planets. And Vega had explained to her that the word Mir meant world, peace, and a self-governing community of peasant households that went back to ancient times. They had talked about whether the world had been more peaceful when its largest political units had been no larger than villages.
"Every village is a planet," Lunacharsky had said, his tumbler held high.
"And every planet, a village," she had returned. Such gatherings would be a little raucous. Enormous quantities of brandy and vodka would be drunk, but no one ever seemed seriously inebriated. They would emerge noisily from the restaurant at 1 or 2 in the morning and try, often vainly, to find a taxicab. Several times he had escorted her on foot, a distance of 5 or 6 kilometers from the restaurant back to her hotel. He was attentive, a little avuncular, tolerant in his political judgments, fierce in his scientific pronouncements. Although his sexual escapades were legendary among his colleagues, he never permitted himself so much as a goodnight kiss with Ellie. This had always distressed her a little, although his affection for her was plain. There were many women in the Soviet scientific community, proportionally more so than in the United States, but they tended to occupy menial to middle-level positions,
And male Soviet scientists, like their American counterparts, were puzzled about a pretty woman with evident scientific competence who forcefully expressed her views. Some would interrupt her or pretend not to hear her. Then Lunacharsky would always lean over and ask in a louder voice than usual, "What did you say, Dr. Arroway? I didn't quite manage to hear." The others would then fall silent, and she would continue about doped gallium arsenide detectors or the ethanol content of the galactic cloud, W3. The quantity of 200-proof alcohol in this single interstellar cloud was more than enough to maintain the present population of the Earth, if every adult were a dedicated alcoholic, for the age of the solar system. The Tamada had appreciated the remark. In their subsequent toasts, they had speculated on whether other forms of life would be intoxicated by ethanol, whether public drunkenness was a galaxy-wide problem, and whether a toastmaster on any other world could be as skillful as our Trofim Sergeyevich Galatsi. They arrived at the Albuquerque airport to discover that, miraculously, the commercial flight from New York with the Soviet delegation aboard had landed a half hour early. Ellie found Vege at an airport souvenir shop, negotiating the price of some trinket. He must have seen her out of the corner of his eye. Without turning to face her, he lifted a finger.
One second, 1995?
He continued, addressing the elaborately disinterested sales clerk.
I saw the identical set in New York yesterday for $17.50.
She edged closer and observed Vege spreading a set of holographic playing cards, displaying nudes of both sexes in poses now considered merely indecorous that would have scandalized the previous generation. The clerk was making half-hearted attempts to gather the cards up, as Lunacharsky made vigorous and successful efforts to cover the counter with the cards. Vege was winning.
"I'm sorry, sir, I don't set prices, I only work here," complained the clerk. "You see the deficiencies of a planned economy,"
Vege said to Ellie, while proffering a $20 bill to the clerk.
"In a true free enterprise system, I probably could purchase this for $15. Maybe $12.95. I don't look at me in that way, Ellie, this is not for me. With the Jokers, there are 54 cards here. Each of them will make a nice gift for some worker at my institute."
She smiled and took his arm. "It's good to see you again, Vege."
"A rare pleasure, my dear."
On the drive to Socorro, by mutual but unspoken agreement, they mainly talked pleasantries. Valerian and the driver, one of the new security people, were in the front seats. Peter, not a voluble man, even in ordinary circumstances, was content to lean back and listen to their conversation, which touched only tangentially on the issue the Soviets had come to discuss, the third level of the palimpsest, the elaborate, complex, and still undecoded message they were collectively receiving. The U.S. government had more or less reluctantly concluded that Soviet participation was essential. This was true especially because the signal from Vega was so intense that even modest radio telescopes could detect it. Years before, the Soviets had prudently deployed a number of small telescopes across the entire Eurasian landmass, stretching 9,000 kilometers over the surface of the Earth, and recently had completed a major radio observatory near Samarkand. In addition, Soviet ocean-going satellite tracking vessels were patrolling both the Atlantic and the Pacific. Some of the Soviet data were redundant, because observatories in Japan, China, India, and Iraq were recording those signals as well. Indeed, every substantial radio telescope in the world that had Vega in its sky was listening. Astronomers in Britain, France, the Netherlands, Sweden, Germany, and Czechoslovakia, in Canada and Venezuela and Australia, were recording small pieces of the message, following Vega from starrise to starset. In some observatories, the detection equipment was not sensitive enough even to make out the individual pulses. They listened anyway to an audio blur. Each of these nations
had a piece of the jigsaw puzzle. Because, as Ellie had reminded Kitz, the Earth turns. Every nation tried to make some sense out of the pulses. But it was difficult. No one could tell even if the message was written in symbols or in pictures. It was perfectly conceivable that they would not decrypt the message until it cycled back to page one, if it ever did, and began again with the introduction, the primer, the decoding key. Maybe it was a very long message, Ellie thought, as Vege idly compared taiga with scrub desert. Maybe it wouldn't cycle back for 100 years. Or maybe there was no primer. Maybe the message, all over the planet, the word was beginning to be capitalized, was an intelligence test. So those worlds, too stupid to decrypt it, would be unable to misuse its contents. It suddenly struck her what a humiliation she would feel for the human species if, in the end, they failed to understand the message. The moment the Americans and the Soviets decided to collaborate, and the memorandum of agreement was solemnly signed, every other nation with a radio telescope had agreed to cooperate. There was a kind of world message consortium, and people were actually talking in those terms. They needed one another's data and brain power if the message was to be decrypted. The newspapers were full of little else. The pitiful few facts that were known, the prime numbers, the Olympic broadcast, the existence of a complex message, were endlessly reviewed. It was hard to find anyone on the planet who had not, in one way or another, heard about the message from Vega. Religious sects, established and marginal, and some newly invented for the purpose, were dissecting the theological implications of the message. Some thought it was from God, and some from the devil. Astonishingly, some were even unsure. There was a nasty resurgence of interest in Hitler and the Nazi regime, and Vege mentioned to her that he had found a total of 8 swastikas in the advertisements in that Sunday's New York Times book review. Ellie replied that 8 was about par, but she knew she was exaggerating. Some weeks there were only 2 or 3. A group that called themselves Space Aryans offered definitive evidence that flying saucers had been invented in Hitler Germany. A new, unmongrelized race of Nazis had grown up on Vega and was now ready to put things right on Earth. There were those who considered listening to the signal an abomination and who urged the observatories to stop. There were those who considered it a token of advent and urged the construction of still larger radio telescopes, some of them in space. Some cautioned against working with the Soviet data on grounds that they might be falsified or fraudulent, although in the longitudes of overlap, they agreed well with the Iraqi, Indian, Chinese, and Japanese data. And there were those who sensed a change in the world political climate and contended that the very existence of the message, even if it was never decrypted, was exercising a steadying influence on the quarrelsome nation-states. Since the transmitting civilization was clearly more advanced than ours, and because it clearly, at least as of 26 years ago, had not destroyed itself, it followed, some argued, that technological civilizations did not inevitably self-destruct. In a world gingerly experimenting with major divestitures of nuclear weapons and their delivery systems, the message was taken by whole populations as a reason for hope. Many considered the message the best news in a long time. For decades, young people had tried not to think too carefully about tomorrow. Now, there might be a benign future after all. Those with predispositions favoring such cheerful prognoses sometimes found themselves edging uncomfortably toward ground that had been occupied for a decade by the Kiliastic movement. Some Kiliasts held that the imminent arrival of the third millennium would be accompanied by the return of Jesus or Buddha or Krishna or the prophet, who would establish on Earth a benevolent theocracy, severe in its judgment of mortals. Perhaps this would presage the mass celestial ascent of the elect. But there were other Kiliasts, and there were far more of these, who held that the physical destruction of the world was the indispensable prerequisite for the advent, as had been unerringly foretold in various, otherwise mutually contradictory ancient prophetic works. The doomsday Kiliasts were uneasy with the whiff of world community in the air, and troubled by the steady annual decline in the global stockpiles of strategic weapons. The most readily available means for fulfilling the central tenet of their faith was being disassembled day by day. Other candidate catastrophes, overpopulation, industrial pollution, earthquakes, volcanic explosions, greenhouse warming, ice ages, or cometary impact with the Earth, were too slow, too improbable, or insufficiently apocalyptic for the purpose. Some Kiliast leaders had assured mass rallies of devoted followers that, except for accidents, life insurance was a sign of wayward faith. That, except for the very elderly, to purchase a gravesite or make funeral arrangements and other than urgent necessity was a flagrant impiety. All who believed would be raised bodily to heaven and would stand before the throne of God in only a few years. Ellie knew that Lunacharsky's famous relative had been that rarest of beings, a Bolshevik revolutionary with a scholarly interest in the world's religions. But the attention Vege directed to the growing worldwide theological ferment was apparently muted.
"The main religious question in my country," he said, "will be whether the Vegans have properly denounced Leon Trotsky."
As they approached the Argus site, the roadside became dense with parked automobiles, recreation vehicles, campers, tents, and great crowds of people. At night, the once tranquil plains of San Agustin were illuminated by campfires. The people along the highway were by no means all well-to-do. She noticed two young couples. The men were in t-shirts and worn jeans, belted around their hips, swaggering a little as they had been taught by their seniors upon entering high school, talking animatedly. One of them pushed a ragged stroller, in which sat a carefree boy about 2 years old. The women followed behind their husbands, one of them holding the hand of a toddler new to the human art of walking, and the other cantilevered forward with what, in another month or two, would be a further life born on this obscure planet. There were mystics from sequestered communities outside Taos who used psilocybin as a sacrament, and nuns from a convent near Albuquerque who used ethanol for the same purpose. There were leather-skinned, crinkly-eyed men who had spent their whole lives under the open sky, and bookish, sallow-faced students from the University of Arizona in Tucson. There were silk cravats and burnished silver string ties sold by Navajo entrepreneurs at exorbitant prices. A small reversal of the historical commercial relations between whites and Native Americans. Chewing tobacco and bubble gum were being vigorously deployed by enlisted men on leave from Davis Month and Air Force Base. An elegantly attired, white-haired man in a $900 suit with a color-coordinated Stetson was just possibly a rancher. There were people who lived in barracks and skyscrapers, adobe hovels, dormitories, trailer parks. Some came because they had nothing better to do. Some because they wanted to tell their grandchildren that they had been there. Some arrived hoping for failure. Others were confident of witnessing a miracle. Sounds of quiet devotion, raucous hilarity, mystic ecstasy, and subdued expectation rose from the crowd into the brilliant afternoon sunlight. A few heads glanced incuriously at the passing caravan of automobiles, each marked U.S. Government Interagency Motor Pool. Some people were lunching on the tailgates of hatchbacks. Others were sampling the wares of vendors whose wheeled emporia were boldly lettered Snackmobile or Space Souvenirs. There were long lines in front of small, sturdy structures with maximum occupancy of one person that the project had thoughtfully provided. Children scampered among the vehicles, sleeping bags, blankets, and portable picnic tables, almost never chided by the adults, except when they came too close to the highway or to the fence nearest Telescope 61, where a group of shaven-headed, kowtowed, saffron-robed young adults were solemnly intoning the sacred syllable,
Ohm. There were posters with imagined representations of extraterrestrial beings, some made popular by comic books or motion pictures. One read, "There are aliens among us." A man with golden earrings was shaving, using the side view mirror of someone's pickup truck, and a black-haired woman in a serape raised a cup of coffee in salute as the convoy sped by. As they drove toward the new main gate, near Telescope 101, Ellie could see a young man on a jerry-built platform importuning a sizable crowd. He was wearing a t-shirt that depicted the Earth being struck by a bolt of celestial lightning. Several others in the crowd, she noticed, were wearing the same enigmatic adornment. At Ellie's urging, once through the gate, they pulled off the side of the road, rolled down the window, and listened. The speaker was turned away from them, and they could see the faces in the crowd. "These people are deeply moved," Ellie thought to herself. He was in mid-oration.
"And others say there's been a pact with the devil, that the scientists have sold their souls. There are precious stones in every one of these telescopes." He waved his hand toward Telescope 101. "Even the scientists admit that. Some people say it's the devil's part of the bargain." "Ah, religious hooliganism," Lunacharsky muttered darkly, his eyes yearning for the open road before them.
"No, no, let's stay," she said. A half-smile of wonderment was playing on her lips.
"There are some people, religious people, God-fearing people, who believe this message comes from beings in space, entities, hostile creatures, aliens who want to harm us, enemies of man."
He fairly shouted this last phrase, and then paused for effect.
"But all of you are wearied and disgusted by the corruption, the decay in this society. A decay brought on by unthinking, unbridled, ungodly technology. I don't know which of you is right. I can't tell you what the message means or who it's from. I have my suspicions. We'll know soon enough. But I do know the scientists and the politicians and the bureaucrats are holding out on us. They haven't told us all they know. They're deceiving us like they always do. For too long, oh God, we have swallowed the lies they feed us, the corruption they bring."
To Ellie's astonishment, a deep rumbling chorus of assent rose from the crowd. He had tapped some well of resentment she had only vaguely apprehended.
"These scientists don't believe we're the children of God. They think we're the offspring of apes. There are known communists among them. Do you want people like that to decide the fate of the world?"
The crowd responded with a thunderous no.
"Do you want a pack of unbelievers to do the talking to God?"
"No," they roared again.
"Or the devil? They are bargaining away our future with monsters from an alien world. My brothers and sisters, there is an evil in this place."
Ellie had thought the orator was unaware of their presence. But now he half turned and pointed to the cyclone fence directly at the idling convoy.
"They don't speak for us. They don't represent us. They have no right to parley in our name."
Some of the crowd nearest the fence began jostling and rhythmically pushing. Both Valerian and the driver became alarmed. The engines had been left running, and in a moment, they accelerated from the gate toward the Argus administration building, still many miles distant across the scrub desert. As they pulled away over the sound of squealing tires and the murmur of the crowd, Ellie could hear the orator, his voice ringing clearly.
"The evil in this place will be stopped! I swear it!"
Chapter 8. Random Access. The theologian may indulge the pleasing task of describing religion as she descended from heaven, arrayed in her native purity. A more melancholy duty is imposed on the historian. He must discover the inevitable mixture of error and corruption which she contracted in a long residence upon earth, among a weak and degenerate race of beings. Edward Gibbon, The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, 15.
Ellie ignored random access and advanced sequentially through the television stations. Lifestyles of the mass murderers and You Bet Your Ass were on adjacent channels. It was clear at a glance that the promise of the medium remained unfulfilled. There was a spirited basketball game between the Johnson City Wildcats and the Union Endicott Tigers. The young men and women players were giving their all. On the next channel was an exhortation in Parsi on proper versus improper observances of Ramadan. Beyond was one of the locked channels, this one apparently devoted to universally abhorrent sexual practices. She next came upon one of the premier computer channels, dedicated to fantasy role-playing games and now fallen on hard times. Accessed to your home computer, it offered a single entry into a new adventure, today's apparently called Galactic Gilgamesh, in hopes that you would find it sufficiently attractive to order the corresponding floppy disk on one of the vending channels. Proper electronic precautions were taken, so you could not record the program during your single play. Most of these video games, she thought, were desperately flawed attempts to prepare adolescents for an unknown future. Her eye was caught by an earnest anchorman from one of the old networks, discussing with unmistakable concern what was described as an unprovoked attack by North Vietnamese torpedo boats on two destroyers of the U.S. 7th Fleet in the Gulf of Tonkin, and the request by the President of the United States that he be authorized to take all necessary measures in response. The program was one of her few favorites. Yesterday's News, reruns of network news shows of earlier years. The second half of the program consisted of a point-by-point dissection of the misinformation in the first half, and the obdurate credulity of the news organizations before any claims by any administration, no matter how unsupported and self-serving. It was one of several television series produced by an organization called Really TV, including Promises, Promises, devoted to follow-up analyses of unfulfilled campaign pledges at local, state, and national levels, and Bamboozles and Baloney, a weekly debunking of what were said to be widespread prejudices, propaganda, and myths. The date at the bottom of the screen was August 5, 1964, and a wave of recollection, nostalgia was not the appropriate word, about her days in high school washed over her. She pressed on. Cycling through the channels, she rushed past an Oriental cooking series devoted this week to the hibachi, an extended advertisement for the first generation of general-purpose household robots by Haddon Cybernetics, the Soviet Embassy's Russian language news and comment program, several children's and news frequencies, the mathematics station displaying the dazzling computer graphics of the new Cornell Analytic Geometry course, the local apartments and real estate channel, and a tight cluster of execrable daytime serials until she came upon the religious networks, where, with sustained and general excitement, the message was being discussed. Attendance in churches had soared all over America. The message, Ellie believed, was a kind of mirror in which each person sees his or her own beliefs challenged or confirmed. It was considered a blanket vindication of mutually exclusive, apocalyptic, and eschatological doctrines. In Peru, Algeria, Mexico, Zimbabwe, Ecuador, and among the Hopi, serious public debates took place on whether their progenitor civilizations had come from space. Supporting opinions were attacked as colonialist. Catholics debated the extraterrestrial state of grace. Protestants discussed possible earlier missions of Jesus to nearby planets, and of course a return to Earth. Muslims were concerned that the message might contravene the commandment against graven images. In Kuwait, a man announced himself as the hidden imam of the Shiites. Messianic fervor had arisen among the Sosafer Hasids. In other congregations of Orthodox Jews, there was a sudden renewal of interest in Astruc, a zealot fearful that knowledge would undermine faith, who in 1305 had induced the rabbi of Barcelona, the leading Jewish cleric of the time, to to forbid the study of science or philosophy by those under 25, on pain of excommunication. Similar currents were increasingly discernible in Islam. A Thessalonian philosopher, auspiciously named Nicholas Polydemos, was attracting attention with a set of passionate arguments for what he called the reunification of the religions, governments, and peoples of the world. Critics began by questioning the re. UFO groups had organized round-the-clock vigils at Brooks Air Force Base near San Antonio, where the perfectly preserved bodies of four occupants of a flying saucer that had crash-landed in 1947 were said to be languishing in freezers. The extraterrestrials were reputed to be 1 meter tall and to have tiny, flawless teeth. Apparitions of Vishnu had been reported in India, and of the Amida Buddha in Japan. Miraculous cures by the hundreds were announced at Lourdes. A new bodhisattva proclaimed herself in Tibet. A novel cargo cult was imported from New Guinea into Australia. It preached the construction of crude radio telescope replicas to attract extraterrestrial largesse. The World Union of Freethinkers called the message a disproof of the existence of God. The Mormon Church declared it a second revelation by the angel Moroni. The message was taken by different groups as evidence for many gods, or one god, or none. Chiliasm was rife. There were those who predicted the millennium in 1999 as a Kabbalistic inversion of 1666, the year that Sabbatai Zevi had adopted for his millennium. Others chose 1996 or 2033, the presumed 2000th anniversaries of the birth or death of Jesus. The great cycle of the ancient Maya was to be completed in the year 2011, when, according to this independent cultural tradition, the cosmos would end. The convolution of the Mayan prediction with Christian millenarianism was producing a kind of apocalyptic frenzy in Mexico and Central America. Some Chileasts, who believed in the earlier dates, had begun giving away their wealth to the poor, in part because it would soon be worthless anyway, and in part as earnest money to God, a bribe for the advent. Zealotry, fanaticism, fear, hope, fervent debate, quiet prayer, agonizing reappraisal, exemplary selflessness, close-minded bigotry, and a zest for dramatically new ideas were epidemic, rushing feverishly over the surface of the tiny planet Earth. Slowly emerging from this mighty ferment, Ellie thought she could see was a dawning recognition of the world as one thread in a vast cosmic tapestry. Meanwhile, the message itself continued to resist attempts at decryption. On the vilification channels protected by the First Amendment, she, Vega, Derheer, and to a lesser extent Peter Valerian, were being castigated for a variety of offenses, including atheism, communism, and hoarding the message for themselves. In her opinion, Vega wasn't much of a communist, and Valerian had a deep, quiet, but sophisticated Christian faith. If they were lucky enough to come anywhere near cracking the message, she was willing to deliver it personally to this sanctimonious twit of a television commentator. David Drumlin, however, was being made out as the hero, the man who had really decrypted the prime number and Olympic broadcasts. He was the kind of scientist we needed more of. She sighed and changed the channel once again. She had come around to TABS, the Turner American Broadcasting System, the only survivor of the large commercial networks that had dominated television broadcasting in the United States until the advent of widespread direct satellite broadcasting and 180-channel cable. On this station, Palmer Joss was making one of his rare television appearances. Like most Americans, Ellie instantly recognized his resonant voice, his slightly unkempt good looks, and the discoloration beneath his eyes that made you think he never slept for worrying about the rest of us.
What has science really done for us? He declaimed. Are we really happier? I don't mean just holographic receivers and seedless grapes. Are we fundamentally happier? Or do the scientists bribe us with toys, with technological trinkets, while they undermine our faith? Here was a man, she thought, who was hankering for a simpler age. A man who has spent his life attempting to reconcile the irreconcilable. He has condemned the most flagrant excesses of pop religion and thinks that justifies attacks on evolution and relativity. Why not attack the existence of the electron? Palmer Joss never saw one, and the Bible is innocent of electromagnetism. Why believe in electrons? Although she had never before listened to him speak, she was sure that sooner or later he would come around to the message, and he did. The scientists keep their findings to themselves, give us little bits and pieces, enough to keep us quiet. They think we're too stupid to understand what they do. They give us conclusions without evidence, findings as if they were holy writ and not speculations, theories, hypotheses, what ordinary people would call guesses. They never ask if some new theory is as good for people as the belief that it tries to replace. They overestimate what they know and underestimate what we know. When we ask for explanations, they tell us it takes years to understand. I know about that. Because in religion also there are things that take years to understand. You can spend a lifetime and never come close to understanding the nature of Almighty God. But you don't see the scientists coming to religious leaders to ask them about their years of study and insight and prayer. They never give us a second thought except when they mislead us and deceive us. And now they say they have a message from the star Vega. But a star can't send a message. Someone is sending it. Who? Is the purpose of the message divine or satanic? When they decode the message, will it end yours truly God or sincerely the devil? When the scientists get around to telling us what's in the message, will they tell us the whole truth or will they hold something back because they think we can't understand it or because it doesn't match what they believe? Aren't these the people who taught us how to annihilate ourselves? I tell you, my friends, science is too important to be left to the scientists. Representatives of the major faiths ought to be part of the process of decoding. We ought to be looking at the raw data. That's what the scientists call it, raw. Otherwise, where will we be? They'll tell us something about the message. Maybe what they really believe, maybe not. And we'll have to accept it, whatever they tell us. There are some things the scientists know about. There are other things, take my word for it, they know nothing about. Maybe they've received a message from another being in the heavens. Maybe not. Can they be sure the message isn't a golden calf? I don't think they'd know one if they saw one. These are the folks who brought us the hydrogen bomb. Forgive me, Lord, for not being more grateful to these kind souls. I have seen God face to face. I worship him, trust him, love him with my entire soul, with all of my being. I don't think anyone could believe more than I do. I can't see how the scientists could believe in science more than I do in God. They're ready to throw away their truths when a new idea comes around. They're proud of it. They don't see any end to knowing. They imagine we're locked in ignorance until the end of time, that there's no certainty anywhere in nature. Newton overthrew Aristotle. Einstein overthrew Newton. Tomorrow someone else will overthrow Einstein. As soon as we get to understand one theory, there's another one in its place. I wouldn't mind so much if they had warned us that the old ideas were tentative. Newton's law of gravitation, they called it. They still call it that. But if it was a law of nature, how could it be wrong? How could it be overthrown? Only God can repeal the laws of nature, not the scientists. They just got it wrong. If Albert Einstein was right,
Isaac Newton was an amateur, a bungler.
Remember, the scientists don't always get it right. They want to take away our faith, our beliefs, and they offer us nothing of spiritual value in return. I do not intend to abandon God because the scientists write a book and say it is a message from Vega. I will not worship science. I will not deny the first commandment. I will not bow down before a golden calf.
When he was a very young man, before he became widely known and admired, Palmer Joss had been a carnival roustabout. It was mentioned in his profile in Times Week. It was no secret. To help make his fortune, he had arranged for a map of the Earth in cylindrical projection to be painstakingly tattooed on his torso. He would exhibit himself at county fairs and sideshows from Oklahoma to Mississippi, one of the stragglers and remnants of a more vigorous age of rural, itinerant entertainment. In the expanse of blue ocean were the four gods of the winds, their cheeks puffing forth, prevailing westerlies and nor'easters. By flexing his pectorals, he could make Boreas swell along with the mid-Atlantic. Then he would declaim to the astonished onlookers from Book 6 of Ovid's Metamorphoses, "Monarch of violence, rolling on clouds, I toss wide waters, and I fell huge trees, possessed of demon rage I penetrate, sheer to the utmost caverns of old earth, and straining up from those unfathomed deeps, scatter the terror-stricken shades of hell, and hurl death-dealing earthquakes throughout the world." Fire and brimstone from old Rome. With some help from his hands, he would demonstrate continental drift, pressing West Africa against South America, so they joined like the pieces of a jigsaw puzzle,
almost perfectly at the longitude of his navel.
They billed him as Geos, the Earthman. Joss was a great reader, and being unencumbered by a formal education past grade school, had not been told that science and classics were unseemly fare for ordinary people. Aided by his casual, rumpled good looks, he would ingratiate himself with librarians in the towns along the carnival's trek and ask what serious books he should read. He wanted, he told them, to improve himself. Dutifully, he read about winning friends and investing in real estate and intimidating your acquaintances without their noticing, but felt these books somehow shallow. By contrast, in ancient literature and in modern science, he thought he detected quality. When there were layovers, he would haunt the local town or county library. He taught himself some geography and history. They were job-related, he told Elvira, the elephant girl, who questioned him closely on his absences. She suspected him of compulsive dalliances. "A librarian in every port," she once said. But she had to admit, his professional patter was improving. The contents were too highbrow, but the delivery was down home. Surprisingly, Joss's little stall began to make money for the carnival. His back to the audience, he was one day demonstrating the collision of India with Asia and the resulting crinkling up of the Himalayas, when out of a gray but rainless sky, a lightning bolt flashed and struck him dead. There had been twisters in southeastern Oklahoma, and the weather was unusual throughout the South. He had a perfectly lucid sense of leaving his body, pitifully crumpled on the sawdust-covered planking, being regarded with caution and something akin to awe by the small crowd, and rising, rising, as if through a long dark tunnel, slowly approaching a brilliant light. And in the radiance, he gradually discerned a figure of heroic, indeed of godlike proportions. When he awoke, he found a part of himself disappointed to be alive. He was lying on a cot, in a modestly furnished bedroom. Leaning over him was the Reverend Billy Joe Rankin, not the present incumbent of that name, but his father, a venerable surrogate preacher of the third quarter of the 20th century. In the background, Joss thought he could see a dozen hooded figures singing the Kyrie eleison. But he couldn't be sure.
Am I gonna live or die?
The young man whispered.
My boy, you're gonna do both,
the Reverend Mr. Rankin replied. Joss was soon overcome with a poignant sense of discovery at the existence of the world, but in a way that was difficult for him to articulate. This feeling was in conflict with the beatific image that he had beheld, and with the infinite joy that vision portended. He could sense the two feelings in conflict within his breast. In various circumstances, sometimes in mid-sentence, he would become aware of one or the other of these feelings making some claim on speech or action. After a while, he was content to live with both. He really had been dead, they told him afterwards. A doctor had pronounced him dead. But they had prayed over him, they had sung hymns, and they had even tried to revive him by body massage, mainly in the vicinity of Mauritania. They had returned him to life. He had been truly and literally reborn. Since this corresponded so well to his own perception of the experience, he accepted the account, and gladly. While he almost never talked about it, he became convinced of the significance of the event. He had not been struck dead for nothing. He had not been brought back for no reason. Under his patron's tutelage, he began to study scripture seriously. He was deeply moved by the idea of the resurrection and the doctrine of salvation. He assisted the Reverend Mr. Rankin at first in small ways, eventually filling in for him in the more onerous or more distant preaching assignments. Especially after the younger Billy Joe Rankin left for Odessa, Texas, in answer to a call from God. Soon Joss found a preaching style that was his own, not so much exhortatory as explanatory. In simple language and homely metaphors, he would explain baptism in the afterlife, the connection of Christian revelation with the myths of classical Greece and Rome, the idea of God's plan for the world, and the conformity of science and religion when both were properly understood. This was not the conventional preaching, and it was too ecumenical for many tastes, but it proved unaccountably popular.
You've been reborn, Joss, the elder Rankin told him. So you ought to change your name.
Except Palmer Joss is such a fine name for a preacher, you'd be a fool not to keep it.
Like doctors and lawyers, the vendors of religion rarely criticize one another's wares, Joss observed. But one night he attended services at the New Church of God Crusader to hear the younger Billy Joe Rankin, triumphantly returned from Odessa, preach to the multitude. Billy Joe enunciated a stark doctrine of reward, retribution, and the rapture. But tonight was a healing night. The curative instrument, the congregation was told, was the holiest of relics, holier than a splinter of the true cross, holier even than the thigh bone of Saint Teresa of Avila, that Generalissimo Francisco Franco had kept in his office to intimidate the pious. What Billy Joe Rankin brandished was the actual amniotic fluid that surrounded and protected our Lord. The liquid had been carefully preserved in an ancient earthenware vessel that once belonged, so it was said, to Saint Anne. The tiniest drop of it would cure what ails you, he promised, through a special act of divine grace. This holiest of holy waters was with us tonight. Joss was appalled. Not so much that Rankin would attempt so transparent a scam, but that any of the parishioners were so credulous as to accept it. In his previous life, he had witnessed many attempts to bamboozle the public. But that was entertainment. This was different. This was religion. Religion was too important to gloss the truth, much less to manufacture miracles. He took to denouncing this imposture from the pulpit. As his fervor grew, he railed against other deviant forms of Christian fundamentalism, including those aspirant herpetologists
who tested their faith by fondling snakes in accord with a biblical injunction that the pure of heart shall not fear the venom of serpents. In one widely quoted sermon, he paraphrased Voltaire. He never thought, he said, that he would find men of the cloth so venal
as to lend support to the blasphemers who taught that the first priest was the first rogue who met the first fool.
These religions were damaging religion. He shook his finger gracefully in the air. Joss argued that in every religion there was a doctrinal line beyond which it insulted the intelligence of its practitioners. Reasonable people might disagree as to where that line should be drawn, but religions trespassed well beyond it at their peril. People were not fools, he said. The day before his death, as he was putting his affairs in order, the elder Rankin sent word to Joss that he never wanted to lay eyes on him again. At the same time, Joss began to preach that science didn't have all the answers either. He found inconsistencies in the theory of evolution. The embarrassing findings, the facts that don't fit, the scientists just sweep under the rug, he said. They don't really know that the Earth is 4.6 billion years old any more than Archbishop Usher knew that it was 6,000 years old. Nobody has seen evolution happen. Nobody has been marking time since the creation. 200 quadrillion, Mississippi, he once imagined the patient timekeeper intoning, counting up the seconds from the origin of the world. And Einstein's theory of relativity was also unproved. You couldn't travel faster than light, no matter what, Einstein had said. How could he know? How close to the speed of light had he gone? Relativity was only a way of understanding the world. Einstein couldn't restrict what mankind could do in the far future, and Einstein sure couldn't set limits on what God could do. Couldn't God travel faster than light if he wanted to? Couldn't God make us travel faster than light if he wanted to? There were excesses in science, and there were excesses in religion. A reasonable man wouldn't be stampeded by either one. There were many interpretations of Scripture and many interpretations of the natural world. Both were created by God, so both must be mutually consistent. Wherever a discrepancy seems to exist, either a scientist or a theologian, maybe both, hasn't been doing his job. Palmer Joss combined his even-handed criticism of science and religion with a fervent plea for moral rectitude and a respect for the intelligence of his flock. In slow stages, he acquired a national reputation. In debates on the teaching of scientific creationism in the schools, on the ethical status of abortion and frozen embryos, on the admissibility of genetic engineering, he attempted in his way to steer a middle course, to reconcile caricatures of science and religion. Both contending camps were outraged at his interventions, and his popularity grew. He became a confidant of presidents. His sermons were excerpted on the op-ed pages of major secular newspapers. But he resisted many invitations and some proffered blandishments to found an electronic church. He continued to live simply, and rarely, except for presidential invitations and ecumenical congresses, left the rural South. Beyond a conventional patriotism, he made it a rule not to meddle in politics. In a field filled with competing entries, many of dubious probity, Palmer Joss became an erudition and moral authority, the preeminent Christian fundamentalist preacher of his day. Dürer had asked if they could have a quiet dinner somewhere. He was flying in for the summary session with Vege and the Soviet delegation on the latest progress in the interpretation of the message. But south-central New Mexico was crawling with the world's press, and there was no restaurant for 100 miles in which they could talk unobserved and unheard. So she made dinner herself in her modest apartment, near the visiting scientists' quarters at the Argus facility. There was a great deal to talk about. Sometimes it seemed that the fate of the whole project was hanging by a presidential thread. But the little tremor of anticipation she felt just before Ken's arrival was occasioned, she was vaguely aware, by more than that.
Joss was not exactly business, so they got around to him while loading the dishwasher. "The man is scared stiff," Ellie said. "His perspective is narrow. He imagines the message is going to be unacceptable biblical exegesis or something that shakes his faith. He has no idea about how a new scientific paradigm subsumes the previous one. He wants to know what science has done for him lately, and he's supposed to be the voice of reason."
"Compared to the doomsday Kiliasts and the Earth Firsters, Palmer Joss is the soul of moderation,"
Dürrheer replied.
"Maybe we haven't explained the methods of science as well as we should have. I worry about that a lot these days. And Ellie, can you really be sure that it isn't a message from God or the devil?"
"Ken, you can't be serious."
"Well, how about advanced beings committed to what we might call good or evil, who somebody like Joss would consider indistinguishable from God or the devil?"
"Ken, whoever those beings are in the Vega system, I guarantee they didn't create the universe. And they're nothing like the Old Testament God. Remember, Vega, the sun, and all the other stars in the solar neighborhood are in some backwater of an absolutely humdrum galaxy. Why should I am that I am hang out around here? There must be more pressing things for him to do."
"Ellie, we're in a bind. You know Joss is very influential. He's been close to 3 presidents, including the present incumbent. The president is inclined to make some concession to Joss, although I don't think she wants to put him and a bunch of other preachers on the preliminary decryption committee with you, Valerian, and Drumlin, to say nothing of Vega and his colleagues. It's hard to imagine the Russians going along with fundamentalist clergy on the committee. The whole thing could unravel over this. So why don't we go and talk to him? The president says that Joss is really fascinated by science. Suppose we won him over.
We're going to convert Palmer Joss.
I'm not imagining making him change his religion. Let's just make him understand what Argus is about. How we don't have to answer the message if we don't like what it says. How interstellar distances quarantine us from Vega.
Ken, he doesn't even believe that the velocity of light is a cosmic speed limit. We're going to be talking past each other. Also, I've got a long history of failure in accommodating to the conventional religions. I tend to blow my top at their inconsistencies and hypocrisies. I'm not sure a meeting between Joss and me is what you want, or the president.
Ellie, he said, I know who I'd put my money on. I don't see how getting together with Joss could make things much worse.
She allowed herself to return his smile. With the tracking ships now in place, and a few small but adequate radio telescopes installed in such places as Reykjavik and Jakarta, there was now redundant coverage of the signal from Vega at every longitude swath. A major conference was scheduled to be held in Paris of the full World Message Consortium. In preparation, it was natural for the nations with the largest fraction of the data to hold a preparatory scientific discussion. They had been meeting for the better part of 4 days, and this summary session was intended mainly to bring those such as Dürrheer, who served as intermediaries between the scientists and the politicians, up to speed. The Soviet delegation, while nominally headed by Lunacharsky, included several scientists and technical people of equal distinction. Among them were Genrikh Arkhangelsky, recently named head of the Soviet-led International Space Consortium called Intercosmos, and Timofey Gotritsky, listed as Minister of Medium-Heavy Industry, and a member of the Central Committee. Vega clearly felt himself under unusual pressures. He had resumed chain-smoking. He held the cigarette between his thumb and forefinger, palm up as he talked.
I agree that there is adequate overlap in longitude, but I'm still worried about redundancy. A failure in the helium liquefier on board the Marshall Nedlin, or a power failure in Reykjavik, and the continuity of the message is in jeopardy. Suppose the message takes 2 years to cycle around to the beginning. If we miss a piece, we will have to wait 2 more years to fill in the gap,
And remember, we don't know that the message will be repeated. If there's no repeat, the gaps will never be repaired. I think we need to plan even for unlikely possibilities.
What are you thinking of? Dirhir asked. Something like emergency generators for every observatory in the consortium?
Yes, and independent amplifiers, spectrometers, autocorrelators, disk drives, and so forth at each observatory, and some provision for fast airlift of liquid helium to remote observatories if necessary.
Ellie, do you agree?
Absolutely.
Anything else?
I think we should continue to observe Vega on a very broad range of frequencies, Vega said. Perhaps tomorrow a different message will come through on only one of the message frequencies. We should also monitor other regions of the sky. Maybe the key to the message won't come from Vega, but from somewhere else.
Let me say why I think Vega's point is important, interjected Valerian. This is a unique moment. When we're receiving a message, but have made no progress at all in decrypting it. We have no previous experience along these lines. We have to cover all the bases. We don't want to wind up a year or two from now kicking ourselves because there was some simple precaution we forgot to take or some simple measurement that we overlooked. The idea that the message will cycle back on itself is the merest guess. There's nothing in the message itself, as far as we can see, that promises cycling back. Any opportunities lost now may be lost for all time. I also agree there's more instrumental development that needs doing. For all we know, there's a fourth layer to the palimpsest.
There's also the question of personnel,
Vega continued.
Suppose this message goes on not for a year or two, but for decades. Or suppose this is just the first in a long series of messages from all over the sky. There are at most a few hundred really capable radio astronomers in the world. That is a very small number when the stakes are so high. The industrialized countries must start producing many more radio astronomers and radio engineers with first-rate training.
Ellie noted that Gotsritsa, who had said little, was taking detailed notes. She was again struck by how much more literate the Soviets were in English than the Americans in Russian. Near the beginning of the century, scientists all over the world spoke, or at least read, German. Before that, it had been French, and before that, Latin. In another century, there might be some other obligatory scientific language, Chinese, perhaps. For the moment, it was English, and scientists all over the planet struggled to learn its ambiguities and irregularities. Lighting a fresh cigarette from the glowing tip of its predecessor, Vega went on.
There is something else to be said, though. This is just speculation. It's not even as plausible as the idea that the message will cycle back on itself, which Professor Valerian quite properly stressed was only a guess. I would not ordinarily mention so speculative an idea at such an early stage. But if the speculation is sound, there are certain further actions we must begin thinking about immediately. I would not have the courage to raise this possibility if Academician Arkhangelsky had not come tentatively to the same conclusion.
He and I have disagreed about the quantization of quasar redshifts, the explanation of superluminal light sources, the rest mass of the neutrino, quark physics in neutron stars. We have had many disagreements. I must admit that sometimes he has been right and sometimes I have been right. Almost never, it seems to me, in the early speculative stage of a subject have we agreed, but on this, we agree.
Genrikh Dmitrich, would you explain?
Arkhangelsky seemed tolerant, even amused. He and Lunacharsky had been for years engaged in personal rivalry, heated scientific disputes, and a celebrated controversy on the prudent level of support for Soviet fusion research.
We guess, he said, that the message is the instructions for building a machine. Of course, we have no knowledge about how to decode the message. The evidence is in internal references. I give you an example. Here on page 15,441 is a clear reference to an earlier page, 13,097. which, by luck, we also have. The later page was received here in New Mexico, the earlier one at our observatory near Tashkent. On page 13,097, there is another reference, this to a time when we were not covering our longitudes. There are many cases of this back-referencing. In general, and this is the important point, there are complicated instructions on a recent page, but simpler instructions on an earlier page. In one case, there are 8 citations to earlier material on a single page.
That's not an awfully compelling argument, guys, replied Ellie. Maybe it's a set of mathematical exercises, the later ones building on the earlier ones. Maybe it's a long novel. They might have very long lifetimes compared to us, in which events are connected with childhood experiences, or whatever they have on Vega when they're young. Maybe it's a tightly cross-referenced religious manual.
The 10 billion commandments, Terhir laughed. Maybe, said Lunacharsky, staring through a cloud of cigarette smoke out the window at the telescopes.
They seemed to be staring longingly at the sky.
But when you look at the patterns of cross-references, I think you'll agree it looks more like the instruction manual for building a machine. Ugh, God knows what the machine is supposed to do.